special program looking at the silver boom, aging in Rhode Island. I'm your host, Dave Fallon. Already, Rhode Island has the largest population, 85 and older, in the nation. And in 20 years, a quarter of the state's population will be 60 plus. Catherine Taylor heads Rhode Island's Division of Elderly Affairs, which coordinates services for the elderly. She divides this population into younger olders, those between 60 and 70, and older olders, those 85 and up. She says the state's trying to figure out why those older olders outnumber the rest.
I've developed a theory that I haven't proved about this, but folks do leave when they retire and they go to Florida, and they take with them their taxable retirement dollars, their purchasing power, their volunteer hours, their help with their family, and they come back when they become frail and are in need of long-term care to be with family.
The cost of taking care of these older residents adds up. A recent survey out of MetLife looked at the cost of long-term care for a year for the different types of services available. It found a year of nursing home care will run about $97,000, and 20 hours a week of in-home care for a year works out to about $25,000. Taylor says the state has a plan on how to care for residents with Alzheimer's. 25,000 people in Rhode Island are diagnosed with Alzheimer's and related dementias, and another 100,000 residents are family members providing care. She says the state is taking a hard look at what it can do to support both patients and caregivers. One population also needing care is the growing number of older residents grappling with substance abuse and addiction. Rhode Island Public Radio healthcare reporter Kristen Gourlay looks at the challenges of matching these seniors with the services they need. She begins our story at a community recovery center in Pawtucket.
Sam Bynum wasn't born an alcoholic, but like many alcoholics will tell you, the signs were there early on.
I remember as a young girl, probably five, standing in the back room of my uncle's bar, the aroma of stale beer that had permeated the walls was enticing to me. I loved it. I loved alcohol as soon as I could drink it.
And she drank, at first to feel a bit less awkward or uncomfortable. Then, after her 7-year-old son died in a car accident, she drank not to feel at all.
And after he passed away, I became a different person. And all I wanted to do was drink and drug because it hid the feelings.
She remarried several times, hit the road with husband number 3, and left her other son with her parents. By her mid-50s, the drinking and drugs had made Bynum sick and poisoned her relationship with her son.
I had done such damage to my son that he was living in Boston. I would have to ask him if I could visit.
But at age 57, she was ready for a change. She remembers raising her hand in a recovery meeting and admitting her problem for the first time.
My name is Sam, and I'm an alcoholic. And it was as if a backpack slid off my back and I was free.
That was a decade ago. Bynum, with her wispy white hair and electric smile, has been sober ever since.
I'm as happy as I could possibly be. I am proud of myself for what I have accomplished.
Today, she tries to help other seniors find the same happiness. She runs some recovery meetings herself, and she's about to start a new group at a nearby senior center. Bynum says older people who abuse drugs or alcohol might especially need that connection to a group of peers.
I find that some seniors, and I am one, have gone through this, of being isolated away from their family, that their family just can't stand it anymore. And the senior gets more into depression, and I have been there.
In downtown Pawtucket, the Anchor Community Center is filling up. The noon Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is about to start, and people of all ages are greeting friends and settling into the rows of folding chairs. The Anchor offers all kinds of support for people in recovery from alcohol and drug addiction, and they're seeing more and more Rhode Islanders over the age of 60, like Sam Bynum. Jim Gillen oversees recovery services for the Providence Center, which also runs the Anchor Center. He says there are a couple of reasons for that increase.
You know, what's happening is that as people are aging out, you know, the baby boomers or the war kids, you know, and if they have a lifetime of drug dependence or you know, drug abuse, including alcohol, you know, it's become as the body breaks down. You know, you can only drink for so many years. It's going to catch up to you at some point.
Prescription medications are another reason. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has found that over the past few years, the number of seniors taking at least one medication has risen to 90%. More than half take three. Drugs for anxiety and pain, like OxyContin or Vicodin, are among the most frequently prescribed, and they're some of the most addictive. Holly Sakala helps run the Providence Center's new drop-in recovery center in Warwick. She's also a member of a state task force on elderly mental health that's just recently started talking about elders and addiction. She says part of the issue is simply identifying the problem in seniors.
A lot of times, primary care physicians will overlook a substance abuse issue in an elder because it's not so forefront. There are other things going on. And typically that the culture of the elders is, you know, we don't talk about our issues that may devalue us in the community.
Sakala says primary care doctors need more training in addiction. And Jim Gillen agrees. In fact, he says primary care doctors could help with another problem, connecting seniors with the help that's out there, but disconnected.
Okay, you're in for primary health care. But now let's talk about, you know, your mental health. Let's talk about your, you know, your maybe abusive pain medications. So if it's all there, you know, and now let's connect you with a recovery coach. So the services are there. It's getting them intertwined. And that's the hard part is really having some person or some agency as the thread.
Federal data show that the number of seniors nationwide entering treatment for substance abuse has grown by 50% in the past few years. That number is steadily creeping up in Rhode Island, too. But the number of services specifically designed for seniors has declined. And Sakala says that's a problem because seniors have some unique needs, physical or psychological, that could keep them from seeking treatment. They might have trouble getting around or have other medical needs. She says that's one reason the Anchor Center started a phone service.
Well, the telephone recovery support service that we provide here is available to people in our community. It allows people to get a call from somebody who really does care how you're doing. And if you're maybe not ready to walk out the door, maybe the telephone recovery support, you know, we'll allow you to trust enough to take the step out the door and come on in and see us.
Then maybe, says Jim Gillen, some seniors will begin to feel comfortable enough to venture out and maybe try a recovery meeting.
And so, you know, it's a slow process, but it's about building trust. And that's important with anyone, but especially with a senior population that for so long has lived in the shadows.
Gillen expects the number of seniors dealing with substance abuse will expand as more baby boomers grow older and more prescription drugs fill up their medicine cabinets. And Rhode Island, he says, will need more treatment options, including sober housing, for this growing population. Kristen Gourlay, Rhode Island Public Radio.
How do you think you'd do if your parents, grandparents, children, dogs, and cats all lived under one roof? Well, Rhode Island Public Radio's Catherine Welch caught up with a family in Woonsocket that has only known a life of everyone living together.
Nothing says home quite like a white picket fence, and Jacqueline Dowdy's got one surrounding her light green triple-decker. Her grandparents bought the place more than 40 years ago. Back then, they lived on the first floor.
My parents lived on this floor. This is the apartment I grew up in, and I had an aunt, one of my mother's younger sisters, who lived on the third floor.
You heard right. Jacqueline Dowdy is raising her family in the same second-floor apartment she grew up in. Dowdy says she always knew she'd return. She bought the home a while ago, and after her grandparents died, she moved her parents down to the first floor and set her family up on the second floor.
And my sister and her family are on the third floor.
It's dinner time, a busy time for Dowdy, who cooks for everyone on the first and second floors. On this night, the meal includes a Woonsocket specialty of beef and peppers known as dynamite.
Last night we had dynamite, and my girls love dynamite, so they're going to have leftovers. And I'm going to fry some chicken and make some homemade gravy and some rice and salad and some corn on the cob for the folks downstairs.
Sitting at the kitchen table, 8-year-old Nyasia squirms in her chair, trying to concentrate on homework. She loves that she can just run downstairs and be with her grandma.
It's actually very fun living with my grandma, because I like to help her, and when she goes to choir rehearsal, she prays for us and stuff, and she helps us sing.
10-year-old Genesis says when she's a little older, she wants her grandma to teach her how to sew and knit. The two girls laugh at the idea of grandma listening to their music or trying to learn computers. But as Dowdy explains, grandma is there for the girls in other ways.
No matter how cold it is, no matter how wet it is, she puts on her coat and her shoes, and she accompanies them to the church every Friday night for choir rehearsal.
Of the two, it's 8-year-old Nyasia who spends the most time downstairs.
She spends a lot of time with Grandma because Grandma gives her snacks all the time, and she shouldn't have them. So she probably spends the most time with Grandma.
Yeah, she comes in from school, and she says, "Can I have a snack?" I said, "Whatever you find, go get it."
79-year-old Ethel Dowdy's family migrated to Rhode Island from South Carolina. It was a large family of 16. She's used to living around a lot of people. Over the years, family members have returned home for the reunions and celebrations. She's convinced that living in the same house has kept her family close, and she hopes her granddaughters will feel a similar bond. So she spends as much time with them as she can, pulling them close and dishing out advice.
That they need to go to school, listen to the teacher, get an education, listen to the parents, and be good to each other. And they won't have problems when they grow up.
Sitting nearby, Nyasia smiles. She's heard all this before. Back upstairs, Mom Jacqueline Dowdy has heard it all too, when she was a kid. She's touched that her girls are getting the same advice she did. And if Dowdy gets her way, someday she will be the grandma downstairs dispensing advice.
I'm hoping that I get to a point where they have to move me on the first floor and they will do for me what I do for her. Honestly, I really, really do.
Families for decades have filled triple-deckers across the state, and there's a rhythm to it that the Dowdy family followed. The first generation buys the home and lives on the first floor. The next generation starts a family and moves into the second floor, and so on. Now, part of this pattern includes leaving the triple-decker. It's a sign that the family has made it. But Jacqueline Dowdy is not leaving her triple-decker. Moving future generations of Dowdys up and down the stairs, that's her idea of success. Catherine Welch, Rhode Island Public Radio.
This is a special program looking at the silver boom, aging in Rhode Island. I'm your host, Dave Fallon. When we return, we'll explore what it means to grow older behind bars, what life is like going back to school when you're older than the teacher, and meet 91-year-old tap dance instructor Teresa Landry. Welcome back. This is a special program, The Silver Boom, Aging in Rhode Island. I'm your host, Dave Fallon. In less than 20 years, a quarter of the state's population will be older than 60. This morning, we're looking at how Rhode Island will take care of this expanding older population and how it can benefit from it. A segment of the older population people might not think about are those who are spending their golden years behind bars. Rhode Island cared for 155 inmates in 2012, and the cost for these older inmates tends to be about twice the amount of younger ones. Rhode Island Public Radio's Flo Jodick visited the medium security prison in Cranston and discovered that older inmates face special challenges.
One tends to think of prisoners as young people, but a fast-growing segment of the corrections population is elderly. Here at the John J. Moran Medium Security Facility in Cranston, you'll find about 50 inmates who are 65 and older. 76-year-old Carlton Blue is one of them.
I'm anti-authority. I always have been. And I admit it. That's my downfall.
Blue has served 20 years of a 55-year sentence for sexual assault, and it doesn't look like he's getting out anytime soon. The parole board has denied 6 bids for freedom because he won't participate in the sex offender treatment program. Blue says the program won't take him because he won't admit his guilt.
I'm not guilty of the actual charge. Like, it was consensual, and it was more or less of a setup. A young lady, 28 years old, picked me up in a bar.
Blue knows there is a very real possibility he'll die in prison.
Hopefully not looking at a wheelchair, let's put it that way. But I know eventually it's going to come. I have to deal with that.
Once a week, Blue and about half a dozen other aging inmates meet to support one another. The group is run by Rhode Island College social work intern Matt Acoin. They allowed us to tape a recent session, provided we did not reveal the inmates' crimes.
Today we're going to be talking about some of the topics that you guys really wanted to talk about, that we talked about last week.
The inmates complain about cold cells, standing outdoors in the rain and snow for medications, and then finding out that their meds order has been lost. 56-year-old Joe Wilson says it's happened to him twice in the past year.
After you go without Prilosec for 3 days, can you imagine the acid reflux and you're sticking your head in your toilet trying to get the acid up out of your stomach? And this time I had to go 2 weeks.
63-year-old Charles Marchetti gripes about the younger inmates.
These young kids come in. They don't know the rules. They don't know the ropes. They don't care to know the rules. They don't want to know the rules. And automatically they start rebelling and bucking. It draws all kinds of cops and heat to you, your cell block, your cell. And that's why the older guys would like their own block.
Although elderly prisoners constitute only 2% of Rhode Island's prison population, they are a fast-growing group. The American Civil Liberties Union National Prison Project projects that geriatric inmates will constitute over a third of the nation's prison population by 2030. The explosion is due to tough-on-sentencing laws passed in the 1980s and 90s. Incarcerating this elderly population is a costly burden to taxpayers. Rhode Island does not break down medical costs by the age of the inmate, but the National Institutes of Health estimates elderly inmates cost 2 to 3 times more than their younger brethren. Rhode Island Department of Corrections Director A.T. Wall says aging prisoners are not eligible for Medicare, but the state does receive Medicaid discounts.
We have geriatric inmates who report a variety of ailments. Almost 50% of our inmates have high blood pressure, with the attendant consequences of it. 42% have mobility issues, arthritis in particular. Another 42% have problems with high cholesterol. And some of these inmates are the same inmates with multiple issues. Diabetes, about 1 in 5 of our geriatric inmates. Almost 1 in 5 of our geriatric inmates have serious mental health issues. So this is a population that is not well and requires special care and costly treatments.
Outside prison walls, geriatric is defined as over 65. But the National Institute of Corrections defines elderly prisoners as those age 50 and up due to unhealthy conditions prior to and during incarceration. Brad Brockman, director of the Center for Prisoner Health and Human Rights at the Miriam Hospital, says the typical prisoner comes in with a number of health issues.
You have rates of HIV at 5 times the general population, hepatitis C, 10 times the population, tuberculosis up to 17 times, and every other thing, asthma, diabetes, you name it, and the illness is at a higher rate just for the general population. So as the population is aging, those health conditions that they've come in with tend to contribute to a quicker deterioration physically and mentally.
The evidence suggests that elderly prisoners who are released back into the community pose little risk to public safety. In Rhode Island, the recidivism rate among prisoners overall is 42%. But among prisoners 55 years and older, it's 4%. David Foti of the ACLU's National Prison Project says society needs to rethink the warehousing of the elderly.
We are long past the point of diminishing returns in using incarceration as a crime control tool. It's bad for families, it's bad for the country, and it is very, very expensive. And it's time that we begin to look at being smart on crime rather than being needlessly and reflexively tough on crime.
Most of Rhode Island's aging inmates are serving long sentences for murder and sexual assault. Even if they are released, it's often difficult to find them housing. Carlton Blue, the 76-year-old sex offender who won't admit he raped a woman, sees the years to come this way.
It's not too bright a future. Let's face it, as you get older, things break down. Your whole system, your legs, you can't walk, your health deteriorates and stuff like that. It's very bleak as far as a future here.
So Blue and the other elderly prisoners look ahead to a life when it will be harder to get to the top bunk, hear an officer's order, or even go to the bathroom. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Another segment of the senior population is the one deciding it's never too late to go back to school. Both Rhode Island College and the University of Rhode Island report that the fastest growing student group is 50-plus. Rhode Island Public Radio education reporter Elizabeth Harrison takes us to the RIC campus to find out why these students are putting on a backpack and heading back to class. So
basically, at the Oasis office on the Rhode Island College campus, tutors speak in hushed tones as they work one-on-one with students who need a little extra help. Senior Sue Botello sits in the reception area. She's waiting for a session on physiological psychology.
No way around it. It's biology. Even if you dumb down biology, it's still biology. You're talking about neurons and action potentials. Yeah, it's really hard.
And it's been a while since she last cracked open a biology textbook. She's 50 years old, majoring in psychology, and part of a small but growing group of older students seeking bachelor's degrees in Rhode Island. Botello diffuses questions about her senior student status with typical good humor.
Yeah, I'm old. Shh. Everybody doesn't know.
What Botello knows is that she can do better than a retail job at Toys R Us, where she worked for more than a decade. So at a time in life when many of her peers are planning for retirement, she's planning for a whole new career as a school psychologist. She calls it her do-over.
I'm smart. It took me a long time to admit I was smart. I wish when I was 20 years old I would have felt it was okay, Susan. Be as smart as you can. Now I appreciate very much that my brain still works.
The number of students at RIC who are 50 and older has grown by 35% over the last 4 years, faster than any other student group. Vice President for Academic Affairs Ron Pitt says that doesn't surprise him. He calls this group the squeeze generation.
That's a group that is facing some real challenges. There have been studies showed recently that in this recession they have lost the greatest amount of income.
And they're often taking care of elderly parents, while in many cases still taking care of children in their 20s living at home. Pitt says many Rhode Islanders in their 50s and older never went to college, but now they find they need a degree to make a better living.
Many of them have lost jobs from industries that are changing greatly or disappearing. So they are really a group that needs to look at and is looking at other ways of retraining themselves and refreshing their skills and elevating themselves through education.
The changing economy is part of what pushed Donald Mangiarelli to enroll at RIC. He was working as a metal plating supervisor at a jewelry company when he lost his job in 2010. Already in his 60s, he faced a decision about whether to retire.
I was sitting there. I said, you know, I don't want to stay home. I want to do something with my life. I've had a lot of job offers, but none, you know, suited me because they don't want to pay anything, you know. Even as a plating supervisor, you know, they didn't want to pay. So I said, well, let me go to college and learn something.
Taking advantage of the GI Bill, Mangiarelli signed up for all kinds of classes to see what would interest him.
Philosophy, math, literature, world history. I'm taking all my courses, all my electives, trying to get those out of the way till I actually see what I want to really go into.
He's leaning toward a major in anthropology and maybe a minor in business. He already has some real-world experience from his days running a family grocery store. And while he seems to embrace his new role as an undeclared college sophomore, he says it can be difficult being the only gray-haired student in the classroom.
A couple times at the class, the first day of class, they see me walking in, and they think I'm the professor, and I sit down with them, and they look at me like, what are you doing here?
Have you been able to make friends?
I make a few friends. You know, it's just that, you know, a lot of them, you know, that's the old man in class.
At the Rick Dining Hall, students hang out and grab a bite to eat between classes. Scanning the tables, it's hard to see a gray hair anywhere. Freshman Steve Lazat says he has seen some older students in his criminology class.
You can just tell, you know, I mean, they had gray hair, they were just older. I don't know why they're taking a criminology class over 50, but whatever.
Lazat complains the older students monopolize discussion, but his friend, 19-year-old Terry Montero, sees an upside.
There's this lady that I've actually been working with. She was a police officer. Like, I look at her as an example. Like, I'm learning from her. So, yeah, so sometimes it does kind of comes in handy working with older people.
And it's not just Rhode Island College where older students are on the rise. At the University of Rhode Island, the number of students age 50 and older has gone up nearly 50% since 2009. The oldest graduate in recent memory finished her bachelor's degree at the age of 80.
Absolutely wanted to have a baccalaureate degree. All the children have been to college, and that was something I wanted for myself. See, my dad, old school.
Teresa Mahoney says when she was growing up in Warwick, college was for boys, not for girls. She finished high school, got married, and had a few kids.
12 children, 6 boys and 6 girls.
And how many grandchildren?
34.
As she pours a cup of coffee in her kitchen, just across the field from the house she grew up in, Mahoney says she always planned to get a college degree later in life. So at 43, she earned an associate's degree in nursing, and at 70, she went to the University of Rhode Island for a bachelor's degree. She decided to study history.
I've always loved history. I love biographies. I love the History Channel. Oh, my goodness, yes. And biographies, oh, absolutely. So it was natural.
Mahoney took her time earning the bachelor's degree, enrolling in one or two classes every semester. It took her 10 years to finish, but she says it was worth it.
And I would tell anyone right now that's going to retire, just keep going for more education, even if you did have a four-year college background. The stimulation of learning, the stimulation of being in an environment with younger people, you have your life experience to bring to them, and they will learn from you.
Now a few years out of college and 82 years old, Mahoney says she's done with school, but she continues to look for new challenges. She recently took up the piano, and she plans to play Carnegie Hall by the time she's 100. Elizabeth Harrison, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Ninety-one-year-old Teresa Landry has been dancing in Central Falls for more than 50 years. And Rhode Island Public Radio's Lydia Rogers caught up with her to find out what keeps this dynamo dancing.
91-year-old Teresa Landry stands in front of a large mirror in one of the 5 dance studios, doing a few moves on the wood floor before her next class arrives. She's a petite woman, dressed in black pants and a black shirt. She's the owner of the Teresa Landry School of Dancing in Pawtucket. 2 days a week in her second-floor studio, she teaches tap dancing. Her students, who are much younger, range from 3 to 16 years old. Landry has been teaching tap in this same room for almost 60 years. But she's taught dance almost her entire life.
Well, I started at 10 years old. My father made me a roller platform. And I had a little wagon, and I put the platform in there, and I go house to teach so that I could get 10 cents per lesson. So I'd have one student on the Monday after school, one on the Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and I would make at least 50 cents a week.
A few years later, while kids her age were still busy being kids, Landry set up a dance school in Central Falls. So not only was she really young, she was also one of the first females to start a business in Central Falls.
When I first opened, I saw a little store that was open for rent. And I thought, oh, I wonder how much she'd want, because now I'm ready. I'm 13, going on 14. Maybe they could rent it to me for one day and I'd do all the teaching there. But when I went to rent it from this Mr. Whalen, he said, you got to give me 1 month ahead of time. I said, oh, but I don't have any money. But trust me, I will pay you on time somehow. So he did trust me.
By the time she was 18, Landry had 100 students a week. Time went by, Landry got married, and she kept on dancing, even while pregnant.
I danced till my 8th month, and then I went back 6 weeks later, so there was nothing lazy about me.
Landry has traveled the world. She's been to Europe, Russia, Cuba, and while her roots are in Central Falls, she's originally from Canada.
I was born in Canada. I came here in a truck of potatoes. My mother knew that if she had two children on her lap, they'd send her back at immigration. So seeing that I was only two, she buried me in the potatoes and just left my little head sticking out. And she said, I like the vibration because I slept all the way through it. I was a good baby. So she got across the immigration because she only had one child on her lap. If she would have had me in front also, in front of the truck with Dad, they would have sent her back. The law then was you could get into the United States with one child.
On a recent day in her Pawtucket studio, Landry gathers a group of young students. One 15-year-old student, who has been coming to the studio since she was three, told me Landry is a great teacher and always up and dancing. 10-year-old Princess Dawn can't believe that her teacher has clocked some 90-plus years.
I was like, how could she be that old and still teaching kids? She's great, awesome. She makes me understand the things she wants me to do. She, like, teaches me in a fun way. It's great.
When the Teresa Landry School of Dancing puts on recitals, Teresa herself works out the choreography.
Who designs the costumes?
I designed them from the time I was a kid. I have a pad, and I must have been looking at movies when I had an extra 10 cents. Because if Ruby Keeler came out with a costume, oh, we had to have something like that. Then Eleanor Powell, which was the world's best female dancer, we had to have a costume like her. And then there was Ann Miller. So if I could get the dime to go see the pictures, it would give me a great idea what to do. Take a skirt from one, a sleeve from another, a bodice from another.
You might think that someone who has been dancing for more than 80 years would be ready to stop. Not Landry.
Well, I don't want to quit because I would like to hang up my shoes and travel some more. But like I say, this is a therapy. And with me, I'm happy to teach 2 days a week because it's my therapy to keep my body going and my mind. At 92, I'm happy that I can get in my car and drive to my business.
She turns 92 in November. But at this point, who's counting? Landry credits a couple of things for living a long and active life.
Well, I don't feel sorry for myself. I push. I really push. I'll take that hot bath, hot and cold shower every day. Doctors say to me when they look at the paper and they go, 11, 24, 21, I don't believe what I'm seeing. You mean you take care of yourself? You take your own bath? You do your own washings? You do your own housework? I said, yes, I do. I don't feel sorry for myself. I push. So at night, I bless myself and say, here goes another day. Let's go, Teresa. Move it. And that's the way I live. And I'm blessed.
Teresa Landry credits her dancing lifestyle for keeping her so healthy and in great shape during her 90-some-odd years. Lydia Rogers, Rhode Island Public Radio.
This is a special program looking at the silver boom, aging in Rhode Island. I'm your host, Dave Fallon. When we return, the future of Social Security and Medicare, growing older gay, and remembering life inside the Gorham manufacturing plant. Welcome back. This is a special program, The Silver Boom, aging in Rhode Island. I am your host, Dave Fallon. In less than 20 years, a quarter of the state's population will be older than 60. This morning, we're looking at how Rhode Island will take care of this expanding older population and how it can benefit from it. What's the future of federal programs like Medicare and Social Security? Rhode Island Public Radio's political reporter Ian Donis looks into that question.
A Brown University PhD student in epidemiology, Beth Lacey, is 28 years old. That means she's a long way from retirement and plans to be working for decades to come. But the debate over the future of Medicare and Social Security are on Lacey's mind, even when she makes one of her regular coffee stops at the Cable Car Cinema in Providence.
It is something I think about. It's not something necessarily that keeps me up at night, but just because of the world I'm in with work and in public health, I definitely think a lot more about Medicare than Social Security.
These federal programs aren't just an abstract concept for Lacey. She says Medicare and Social Security have been a saving grace for her family due to the declining health of her grandparents. Lacey thinks federal programs created to help the elderly during the New Deal and Great Society eras remain important.
My personal view is that we need these government programs. I think that there are other areas of the budget that should be cut before programs such as Social Security or Medicare should be cut. I think that as you move through society and get older, you should be able to rely on the fact that there's something there to support you.
The extent to which Medicare and Social Security will be there to support future retirees is a subject of growing political debate. That's because a huge demographic increase of retiring baby boomers will dramatically ramp up the cost of the two programs.
How you get Medicare and why you get Medicare and when you get Medicare has to be revisited.
That's the outgoing chairman of the state Republican Party, Mark Zakaria. He's familiar with the federal entitlement debate after making two unsuccessful runs for Congress. Like many Republicans in Congress, Zakaria sees Medicare and Social Security as symptoms of out-of-control federal spending. He says the disconnect between what the government takes in and what it spends could eventually destroy the economy.
I hate to be a prophet of doom, but if you keep spending on your credit card in your own personal budget with no regard to paying for it or anything like that, they'll cut you off. And all of a sudden, when it comes time to your electric bill or your food bill or something that's really important, you're not going to be able to do it.
On the other side of the partisan aisle, Democratic Congressman David Cicilline made his opposition to Social Security and Medicare cuts a focal point of his successful re-election campaign last year. Like most Democrats, he calls Medicare and Social Security part of a social contract between the government and its citizens.
These programs were created because they reflect our values as a country, that we wanted to ensure that when you reach a certain age in life, that you can be guaranteed to have the ability to meet your basic needs through Social Security and live with dignity. And we created Medicare because we decided as a country that when you reached a certain age, you should be guaranteed access to quality, affordable health care. And those reflect important American values.
An annual report by trustees of the two programs calls for Congress to tackle the financial challenges facing Medicare and Social Security as soon as possible. Acting sooner, they say, will leave more options and allow the public adequate time to prepare. Most observers agree that strengthening Social Security is simpler than doing the same for Medicare, at least in theory. Yet continuous gridlock in Washington raises questions about Congress's ability to craft solutions for these programs with broad public support. Find a group of seniors, and you're likely to find someone unhappy with previous cuts to safety net programs. Sitting in a booth with friends at the Dunkin' Donuts on Smith Hill, Mary Fallon shared her view on the value of Medicare and Social Security over a cup of coffee.
Well, I think they're important because, you know, a lot of people have retired, and they're dependent on these things. And besides that, we have paid into this all our lives. And they have cut a lot of things, and I still see a lot more cuts coming.
The latest GOP budget unveiled this week does include a controversial proposal to replace Medicare's guaranteed benefits with a voucher that can be used in the private insurance market. It's an approach they've rolled out before. It emphasizes the Republican focus to reduce expenses by cutting spending and benefits. By contrast, Democrats like Cicilline favor strengthening Social Security by increasing how much some of the wealthiest Americans pay into the program. Cicilline says reducing the cost of health care is the way to shore up Medicare.
The real answer is to recognize it's not Medicare that's the problem. It's the health care system. Reform that and fix that so we can provide every American with access to quality, affordable health care.
The cost of Medicare and Social Security will continue to spike as baby boomers retire in big numbers in the years to come. With few signs of compromise in Washington, the question remains whether Congress will be able to defuse this ticking fiscal time bomb before it's too late. Ian Donis, Rhode Island Public Radio.
In Chicago, the city council approved a land transfer and city funding for an affordable housing complex just for gay and lesbian seniors. The New York City area has community centers focused on an aging gay population. And here in Rhode Island, Bradley Campbell talks with Sally Hay, program coordinator at SAGE Rhode Island, about what is being done and what needs to be done better to make older members of the state's gay community feel at home.
Sally, your organization advocates for Rhode Island's gay and lesbian seniors. What circumstances does this population face that are different from their straight peers?
As a rule, this population, the older LGBT folks, are less likely to have children. They're less likely to have a partner. They have fewer resources as they get older in terms of support services.
Could you share some of the experiences that gay and lesbians have had, specifically at senior centers?
One of the dilemmas is that we don't have much research. So much of what we hear is anecdotal. And so I can share that I've known of friends down in South County who participate in their senior center as a couple, a lesbian couple, and they have a fabulous time. It's fine. I've heard of other stories where folks have felt very uncomfortable that there was they felt that many of the seniors at the center were somewhat homophobic and they were reluctant to come out and didn't feel comfortable. So it kind of covers the spectrum right now in terms of comfort zone.
What was one of those anecdotes about, specifically about the homophobia that some of these people faced at the senior center?
The one story that comes to my mind right now was just somebody overhearing comments about, oh, that's so gay. What's wrong with that person? You know, and being very derisive about somebody who was identified as gay. Ellen DeGeneres gets a lot of trash talk sometimes amongst older folks. And so overhearing that, it certainly gives the message that it's not okay to be out.
Really? You're saying that it's not even okay to be out at a senior center?
Oh, absolutely. You know, something that we've talked a little bit about is the age divide amongst the seniors. And I'm on the younger side of 65, and it seems to be 65 and older is a group that grew up with intense repression internally and from the society. And so they've been in the closet a good part of their lives, typically. And so it's always a coming out process. So it's not a surprise that they would have to entertain the notion of, do I come out? Folks who get older, you start to feel more vulnerable. So yeah, it's not an easy slam dunk issue that you're going to be out at your local senior center.
Do you feel that this issue is even greater for the generation above you, folks that are in their 70s and 80s?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And why, what did they face that was different from even, your own generation growing up?
Well, they would have grown up in the generation when there literally wasn't a vocabulary to refer to themselves by. You know, we weren't using words like gay and lesbian easily. Homosexual was very much a medical diagnosis. They grew up in an era when it was seen as literally an illness, a mental illness. You could be easily arrested, lose your job, forcibly hospitalized at a psychiatric hospital.
Sally, you work as an advocate for Rhode Island's gay and lesbian seniors. What are some of the concerns that they have?
I think one of the things people would like would be to know that there are more LGBT-friendly community services available to them so that they could be reassured that it would be safe and that they'd be comfortable that they're not going to be discriminated against. There's a huge fear of discrimination, particularly when you start getting into the older 70, 80, 90-year-old folks, much greater fear about discrimination. And some of it's based in reality, and some of it's just based on what they've learned growing up, that it's not a safe world.
And so the overall goal is just to make sure the people who are asking for these services feel reassured
right.
that they won't experience any discrimination when they're right. trying to get services that they need.
Yeah, and that can be really challenging because what Sage found in a recent survey we did was a number of, well, majority of healthcare organizations that we surveyed believe that they are LGBT friendly. And they base that on the sense that they treat all their clients, all their patients the same. And what they don't realize is you have to be proactive with the LGBT population, and particularly older folks, because, you know, for example, if I go into a setting and all I see are pictures of heterosexual couples, and if the intake form asks me, you know, am I married, widowed, divorced kind of thing, I know because I've spent decades understanding that what you're telling me is you are not LGBT friendly. And so what we're trying to help well-meaning healthcare providers understand is that there are unique needs and that they will actually have to be proactive in reaching out to the LGBT community to convey that they are, in fact, welcoming.
What else do you think is important for our listeners to know about this topic that we've been talking about, the aging gay and lesbian community mm-hmm. within Rhode Island?
Well, we'll start with that we exist. I guess just realizing that there are lesbian and gay folks amongst the elder population, and the elder population, I hope, will think about the fact that, that many of their cohort may be lesbian or gay. And we're getting now older folks who are going through with being transsexual. So there's a lot going on, and I hope that they'll be open to that.
That was Sally Hay, the program coordinator for Sage Rhode Island. Sage is an organization that advocates for the state's gay and lesbian seniors.
One thing to remember about our older population is that they are the memory keepers, the informal historians of this state's rich past. Through much of the last century, Gorham Manufacturing was one of the largest makers of silver flatware and tea sets. Hundreds of workers filed into the massive plant in Providence, making some of the most coveted silverware and bronze casting. The old plant was demolished nearly 15 years ago, but the memories remain in the people who work there. Rhode Island Public Radio's Catherine Welch talked to three former employees about their lives at the Gorham plant, and here are their stories.
I'm William Smith, and I started there in October 1967 until February of 1993.
Donald E. Milner. I started in 1959. I left in 1994.
My first name is Paul. My last name is MacDonald. I worked in the Gorham Company from the mid-60s up until the late 70s. They made tea sets, waiters that they call me, you know, the trays.
Teaspoons, place spoons, place forks, salad forks.
Bronze plaques and statues.
Independent Man on the top of our dome was cast and made in the Gorham Foundry. When you had Gorham, you had the best. I was a maintenance machinist at the Gorham Company. A lot of the equipment in Gorham was made by Gorham. They were all specialized presses and drop hammers and things like that.
I worked in a machine shop in the foundry. We made cremation urns. We would get flat stock. We would cut it and draw it up to fold it up to make an urn. And then I would silver solder it, the edges, okay? And then we would take it over, we would solder in the where we're going to put the feet, and then we would drill it and tap it, tap, 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 so we'd be able to hitch the feet to the cremation urn. And then we would take it over for the grinder machine, which I would grind it, make it nice and smooth. One urn would take you maybe an hour and a half. I would do about 20 a day.
On the drop presses, I would set up the machine and then run the machine and actually form the blanks into various different spoons, forks, and knives. And you would place this on top of a die, it was called. And the die was shaped like a spoon. The machine would just form it together by dropping and, you know, hitting it together. It was just like a thud.
Boom,
thud.
Boom, boom, boom.
Like something
boom,
dropping.
Boom, boom, boom.
Kaboom, kaboom, kaboom,
Kaboom.
Kaboom. And they would sound like small hand grenades going off if you were in the military.
Ba-ba-bum, 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 ba-ba-bum. And you're hearing this all day long. All day long. If you didn't pay attention and you didn't have your mind in the right place, you could get hurt.
Where Bill worked, that was a dangerous job. A lot of people got hurt.
And I've seen people get hurt.
When I first walked in that door, they showed us one job, and they would, you would take a spoon and you put it in a die. Boom! So they asked me, you want to work there? I looked at these. I said, no. I made sure I kept my hands.
There were many operators. We used to call them three fingers, you know, because they always had one or two fingers missing.
Well, people losing their fingers. This one particular day, the guy who got hurt ran by me, and all I saw was blood. I went to the boss's office, and I said, I'm going home today. And he looked at me, he goes, no problem.
We had many eye injuries, flying silver. We even had someone who was working on the drop press. The guy set the dies, he dropped the press, and the blank flew out and stabbed him in the belly. And they were so stunned by that had happened, and this is true. The foreman came over and said, what is going on? He put another blank in there and he got stabbed.
We used to have what they call a 25-year club. Once you were there after 25 years, you went out, they had barrels of beer, they had all the best food you could ever want, and it was a great day. It was a great day. And with the 25 years, you'd get a silver bowl. I mean, not plate, silver. I still have mine.
Everything I have, I really owe to either the union or the Gorham Company, because it gave me a great opportunity. It let me put down some roots. I raised my family with the Gorham Pay.
I did have a lot of fun. I had made a lot of friends.
I never mind getting up in the morning and going to any job I ever had. It was a great company to work for. The union was good. The people you worked with were good. And I don't see too many companies like that today.
The strike they had in 1975 was a very, very difficult strike.
It was worse than difficult. I knew one guy, he lost his life over it. He committed suicide.
We struck over that issue as to whether a worker could go with his work or not. And that was, I hate to say it, but it was the worst possible strike you could probably have. It actually caused a mortal blow to the company.
We used to make these bowls, and we sold them by the ton. We sold them. That's how big it was. We lost that completely.
And you know what? That was right at the particular time when places like Korea, Japan, all those Asian markets were beginning to make and manufacture stainless steel. In fact, I recall when they used to let the people from Japan and Korea come into the plant, and they would come in there, believe it or not, where they'd have cameras, and they were taking pictures, and all of us workers, the dummies we were smiling at them, but they weren't taking pictures of us. They were taking pictures of our equipment. Our equipment, for the most part, was made in the Gorham Company. They couldn't go out and buy that, but we didn't realize it.
We moved from Providence to Smithfield. In the mid-80s, all the operations went to a smaller building.
When Gorham's was up in Smithfield, the Gorham trade of making sterling flatware was slowly dying all over this country.
And that was the beginning of the end.
When I went to work in the machine shop, I never dreamed in my wildest dreams that I would ever become president of that union. And my last day, I went into my machine shop to pick up a few things, but I had a sport jacket on, a little briefcase, and all the guys began to hoot and holler and call me names. That was my last day at Gorham.
Well, it's just like you die and you're going to heaven. You know you're going to a better place. Paul was leaving the presidency, and I was vice president, so I immediately moved up. There was no way I could do two. I couldn't stay working and do the job that I was going to take over, and I didn't want to. So I went. I went over to personnel, and we drew up a leave of absence. And that was my last day of work. That was it.
I heard a rumor they're letting some management go. When it came down, it was 3:00 in the afternoon. I was called into personnel. And that's when they had everything waiting for me, you know, the severance package. They said, don't take it personal, it's economics. And I thought, that's easy for you to say. This is my life here. I gave 25 years of my life here. It felt horrible. I'm not too proud to say that I cried all the way home. When a factory starts up, like back in the day in Gorham, it builds a community. When you leave that environment and you're kind of tossed out the door, you kind of lose contact with them.
It took some of the best manufacturing jobs in the state when they left.
There'll never be another Gorham company.
This has been a special program looking at the silver boom, aging in Rhode Island. I'm Dave Fallon. For more on this series, including photos and special graphics, visit the Silver Boom page at our website, ripr.org.